Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At dawn, a deal on financial reform. Here's Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank.
With the votes of the House and the Senate, conferees in favor of passage of the bill, I declare the bill passed and the conference committee is now adjourned.
McChrystal fired, Petraeus takes over. The president tells why.
I don't think that we can sustain that unity of effort and achieve our objectives in Afghanistan without making this change.
And a judge lifts the ban on deep water drilling. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal says it's the right decision.
The bottom line is this: the fact that the federal government can't do their job shouldn't cost thousands of Louisianians our jobs. What we're saying very simply to the administration is, I hope they'll reconsider this decision to appeal.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines, and you can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Is this the deal you are looking for on financial reform? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me this hour from Washington, D.C. is Tom Gelton. As a correspondent for NPR, he covers a wide variety of global security and economic issues. Tom Gelton, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Jane.
And from New York City, we're joined by Betsy Stark. She's former business correspondent for ABC News. Betsy Stark, a big welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Jane. Good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, as always, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Tom, and Betsy.
Well, let's begin with the news overnight in Washington that after a marathon 20-hour session, House and Senate lawmakers have reached a deal on financial reform. It's the most far-reaching rewrite of financial rules since the Great Depression. Betsy Stark, your reaction?
It's a big deal, Jane. It's a big overhaul. I'm sure we're going to hear those who say it goes too far and those who say it doesn't go far enough. But I do think it's going to go down in history as landmark legislation, a bill that's mindful of protecting depositors and taxpayers from the fallout of a future financial crisis. It's going to regulate the $615 trillion derivatives market. It's going to have a version of the so-called Volcker Rule, which is going to limit the ability of banks that hold depositors' money to make risky trades for their own accounts. It's going to establish a consumer protection agency within the Fed, but with independent authority. Will it prevent another financial system collapse? Of course, there are no guarantees, but it's going to step up the oversight, and it's going to create an FDIC-like mechanism for taking over big banks at the risk of failing. So I think they did a lot of work.
Tom Gelton, help us understand from your perspective the more important details of this legislation. What are its important elements to you?
Well, Betsy's been covering this stuff for years, and I don't want to second guess anything that she said or try to elaborate on it. I mean, the Volcker Rule and the derivative regulations are really key. I think the bottom line here is the extent to which banks should be regulated in terms of the amount of risk that they take on in their own investments. I mean, what we have seen in the past few years with the financial crisis is that banks took on way too much risk. And this has been an effort to really limit the amount of risk that banks are going to be exposed to. And I think the fight was between those who think the banks really need to be regulated more tightly and those who thought, as Betsy said at the beginning, those who really didn't want to be too hard on the banks. For some compromise was needed in order for this legislation to be advanced, and that was what was reached overnight.
Jack Beatty, how do you see this legislation?
Well, I think it's the absolute best that could be done in our current investor-driven political regime. $500 million spent over the last year, perhaps even less than that, by the financial services industry to get a bill they want. They didn't get everything they want. That's something to celebrate. And I think the bill brings us back to where we were, really, to the path we left in the 1980s. That is, the reforms of the Depression era really worked pretty well right up until the Reagan era, when deregulation started. And that wasn't just Republicans. The crucial element in deregulation was under Bill Clinton and the Democrats, the deregulation of the of derivatives. And now 10 years and a catastrophic recession later, that's going to be regulated. So I think historically that turn is very, very significant.
Let's listen to Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas speaking about the importance of passing this financial regulation for the country.
This is such an important task, and I know everyone here takes it seriously. I certainly do. And in listening to my constituents who have approached me about the serious nature of the economy that they have experienced, whether it's losing their children's college funds, whether it's retirement or other things, they want us desperately to get this right.
Betsy Stark, this bill has been the subject of furious and expansive lobbying efforts by businesses and financial trade groups in recent months, as Jack made reference. What didn't make it into this bill? I'm curious what's not in it that perhaps should be.
Well, I think it's a matter of the extent to which the things that did get into it, how fully they did get into it. The banks were, consumer advocates were looking for stricter regulation of the derivatives market. I mean, banks will still be able to trade some derivatives. They were looking for a really strict separation between investment banking and plain vanilla deposit banking. They were looking for an independent consumer protection agency with very far-reaching authority. So none of those things got into this bill to the extent that some had hoped. But on the other side, you're going to hear complaints as well. You're going to hear, I think, from Wall Street and the business community that this is going to restrict access to credit. It's going to hurt capital formation in the United States. It's going to send some of that business overseas to big foreign banks that are not as heavily regulated. So, as I said before, I think you're going to hear complaints on both sides, and sometimes that suggests that maybe somebody got something right.
Tom Gelton, the legislation comes just in time for President Obama to brief foreign leaders on the complete deal at the G20 summit in Canada. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said the final bill was strong. He said it provides, quote, crucial momentum for global financial reform. How do you see that aspect of it?
Well, in that sense, the timing could not have been better. It was really important, I think, for the Obama administration to have this deal reached before the summits in Toronto. I say summits because it's the G8 and the G20, and different issues really with each summit. I mean, with the G8 countries, the big issue right now is international financial regulation, really having to do with how much capital requirements banks have to meet in each of the countries. There has been hope that there can be global coordination of these standards. And also a lot of debate internationally around fiscal measures, whether it's time to sort of pull back on stimulus spending and really focus on debt, or to really keep the stimulus programs around the world on track until the global recovery is more secure. The United States has been pushing for a continuation of stimulus spending, while some of the European countries, which are basically freaked out right now about their debt issues, Germany in the lead, are very nervous about that. So I think that this deal really strengthens President Obama's hand as he heads to Toronto for these meetings.
Betsy Stark, quickly, where does this bill go from here?
Well, I think now what we heard just today is that there should be a vote on it by July 4th. So, and it is what I'm hearing is that there is momentum for it to pass.
So let's move on to this week's Senate Democrats abandoning efforts to provide fresh aid to state governments and denying extension of unemployment benefits for millions of jobless workers in this country. Jack Beatty, what's the rationale behind that decision?
Well, it wasn't their decision. It was something forced on them by a Republican filibuster joined by one Democrat, Ben Nelson of Nebraska. And, in the debate, the Republicans kept saying we have to think about the deficit. The public wants us to think about the deficit. In fact, here are some poll numbers. Which worries you more, Job situation, 41%. Federal budget deficit, 23%. That's one poll. Fox News in May, 47-15. Job situation over deficit. CBS in April, 27-5. So the public wants jobs. And what are they getting? They're getting nothing. 1.2 million Americans are going to lose, are not going to get their extended unemployment benefits. The effect of this, of course, is essentially when President Obama goes to the summit, he won't be able, he really is going to have to say, we are stopping in America our stimulus, because unemployment benefits, for every dollar in unemployment benefits, it generates $1.93% in GDP. It's the best elixir possible for the economy. To give up on that is essentially to give up on the idea of any kind of stimulus. And it's just a bad day for the people who are going to suffer, but also for the economy. And the signal here is, if there is a double dip in this, if there's another downturn, will the Republicans abate this filibuster? Will they allow people to get unemployment benefits? We just don't know.
Tom Gelton, does this decision leave in limbo President Obama's push for more spending to bolster the economy?
Well, I think it does. I think that the administration has already given up on having as much of a continuation of the stimulus program as it really wants. It's looking to scale back those efforts right now. And the Republicans have made this really issue number one. I mean, they're pushing this big nationwide town hall meeting today to really focus on the debt and to push the issue of the debt really to the top of the agenda. So I think that President Obama really has an uphill struggle here.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week in the news with our news roundtable. We're joined this hour by NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, former ABC business correspondent Betsy Stark, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Before we move on to international news, Betsy Stark, I wanted to give you an opportunity to chime in on the Senate Democrats' decision to abandon unemployment benefits for millions of jobless workers.
You know, to my mind, Jane, what this is simply emergency safety net funding. We've got not just an unemployment problem in this country, but we've got a long-term unemployment problem. We've got 15 million Americans out of work, and nearly 7 million of them have been out of work for more than 6 months. And we still don't have companies hiring very much. We've got a job growth rate that's very anemic. So I think to cut off this lifeline to families still caught in this kind of epidemic of long-term unemployment is going to continue to fuel voter anger at millionaires in the Senate, so to speak, and is also going to deprive them of a very vital lifeline that is kind of leads to spending on basic necessities, as Jack pointed out.
We also have state budgets across this country in real trouble, don't we, Betsy?
We do. I mean, we have, unlike the federal government, states are required to balance their budgets, and they are simply unable to do that. There's been a huge loss of tax revenue flowing into their coffers, and the federal government's aid to states is now something that is in jeopardy. So states, as they make those efforts to balance their budgets, are laying off public workers, teachers, firefighters, closing libraries and parks. And, it's a very painful way to go about managing the deficit.
Well, let's move from these domestic issues to international ones. And at a very important press conference on Wednesday, President Obama announcing to this country that he is replacing General Stanley McChrystal, commander of the Afghanistan war. He says it was necessary to ensure success in Afghanistan.
I've just told my national security team that now is the time for all of us to come together. Doing so is not an option, but an obligation. I welcome debate among my team, but I won't tolerate division. All of us have personal interests. All of us have opinions. Our politics often fuels conflict. But we have to renew our sense of common purpose and meet our responsibilities to one another and to our troops who are in harm's way and to our country.
Tom Gelton, did the president make the right decision?
Jane, I think that President Obama made the only decision he could have made in this circumstance. And I think an important point to keep in mind is that despite the really charged partisan environment in which we seem to be operating these days here in Washington, this was a decision that was really greeted with support from both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals. Two very important principles were at stake here, Jane. One is the civilian control of the military, and that's a bipartisan principle. That's something that is really at the foundation of our democratic system. Some of the remarks that General McChrystal and his aides made about their civilian leaders, we're really intolerable if that principle is to be upheld. And the second one, which is evident in the clip of President Obama that you just played, is that this had gotten to the point where there was really sharp infighting on the president's national security team. And as he said, he will not tolerate divisions on that team. So I think that given the divisions that these remarks had made, had revealed, and given the challenge to civilian control, I don't think that he had any choice but to make the move that he did.
And so, Tom, will this change the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan in any way now with David Petraeus at the helm?
Well, it won't change it, Jane, but what it will do is it will really force President Obama to reaffirm his commitment to that strategy. There had been some waffling, I think, certainly on the part of some of President Obama's supporters who were getting very nervous about the slow progress in Afghanistan. And I think by putting General Petraeus in charge in Afghanistan and by coming out as forcefully as he did on Wednesday in support of the current policy, I think that what President Obama has done here is really reaffirmed his commitment to go charging ahead with this policy. It really, for the moment, it closes the door on any kind of rethinking of that policy.
Let's go to a caller on this point in Somerville, Massachusetts. Niles is calling. Welcome to On Point. Niles, hello.
Hello, Jane. I challenge you to find any position outside of the military, any at all, that you can question and disparage your management so much and still expect to retain your job. I mean, within the military, it's much more codified what actions are acceptable, and it's amazing to me that people are confused about how President Obama could possibly dismiss McChrystal. But I can't imagine any civilian job that would allow you to talk about your managers like that and still go back to work the next day.
Niles, thank you. Jack Beatty, the last time a president directly stepped in to remove the senior commander in a war zone was 60 years ago, right when President Harry Truman fired General Douglas MacArthur. Was this President Obama's MacArthur moment?
Yes, but the parallel is an ominous one for President Obama, because the Korean War, as Tom Gelton brilliantly pointed out in this morning's news, morning edition, dragged on. And in 1952, President Truman couldn't run for re-election. The saying was, a dog catcher from Independence could do better than he could. He had to step aside to a Republican team led by a general. I wonder who that could be for 2012. So it's an ominous parallel because the war does drag on. And I thought to me the take home from this article was the deep incoherence that the president has tolerated. His general wouldn't talk to his ambassador. His ambassador and Richard Holbrooke, the man in the State Department with that portfolio, they wouldn't talk. And this clash of personalities mirrored a sort of contradiction in policy. On the one hand, the McChrystal policy, the surge, counterinsurgency. Models, Vietnam, French and Algeria, very successful. 10 years, maybe, another $1 trillion to make that work. On the other hand, the Eikenberry idea. If you keep, if you give them an open-ended commitment, they'll be dependent on you. You have to set a time limit. So we have the time limit, 2011. That, of course, defeats the very logic of the counterinsurgency campaign. And then third, you get the sacrifice of tactics to strategy. The article brought home poignantly how our soldiers now are at risk, are being put at risk, because they have to avoid what McChrystal called insurgent math. That is, if you kill civilians, you create 10. For every civilian you kill, you create 10 insurgents. The result is, of course, they're exposed to more fire. So it's a very, very tangled position indeed. And the president has tolerated this. This is his policy, and I think it's a it borders on being irresponsible.
Here's yesterday on Good Morning America on ABC, Senator John McCain. He says he supported the president's choice to replace General McChrystal with former Iraq commander and current commander of U.S. Central Command, General David Petraeus.
Completely understandable why the president made the decision that he did, based on the civilian-military relationship, which goes a long way back, including Harry Truman. But I also pointed out to the president that, along with my strong support of General Petraeus, we need a new team over there as well, perhaps at the embassy and other areas. The relationship between civil and military is not what it should be.
Betsy Stark, jump in here. What is public support for this war looking like from your eyes?
You know, I think it's just right to bring up that point, Jane, because I think while we were riveted by the high drama and really the tragedy of watching a four-star general who no one seems to dispute was a warrior, patriot who served his country with great skill and devotion, essentially commit an unforgivable breach that led to the end of his service. I think what this also did was it put front and center the uncomfortable reality of a very unpopular war, one that has dragged on for 9 years, cost thousands of lives, and has raised serious questions among Americans, as it has among soldiers on the ground, as Jack was suggesting, about whether this counterinsurgency campaign is really working and is really worth it.
Let's go to the phones again to Will now in Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Will. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel that the firing of General McChrystal is more endemic of just a bigger problem in Afghanistan. I would be willing to bet that a lot of soldiers are unsure about the mission there. I just feel that President Bush missed the window of opportunity back in 2002 or so, and we're never going to get that window back. I'm sorry to say that, but I do realize that there's a political movement to try and win this, but I just think it's a lost cause.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you called. Here's another call from New Haven, Connecticut. Seth on the line. Hi, Seth. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Thanks. My only comment is that kind of dissent is basically totally inappropriate, except maybe behind closed doors, face-to-face with his superiors. I mean, we have elected officials in this country separate from the military for a reason. And they can dissent, but only in private, in meetings and stuff, not publicly like that. That's crossing the line. So it's totally appropriate that he's been let go.
Seth, thank you. Tom Gelton, let me ask you about that. I'm looking at a piece in Politico here that quotes the editor of Rolling Stone, Eric Bates, that General McChrystal was informed of the quotes that were used in the publication as part of their standard fact-checking process and that the general did not object or dispute any of them. Asked if General McChrystal pushed back on the story, Bates responded, no, absolutely not. How do you explain General McChrystal's remarks, how he said it, what he said in Rolling Stone?
The only explanation, Jane, is that General McChrystal is a soldier and a warrior, but he's not very good at politics and public relations. And keep in mind, this is not the first time that he's sort of had a faux pas in terms of his public comments. He publicly challenged Vice President Biden at the height of the debate, the pre-surge debate over what policy the United States should advance in Afghanistan. He's never been known to be really sharp politically in terms of dealing with the press and dealing with his rivals in Washington. And I think that we saw some evidence of that here. One other point I want to throw in, Jane, and mm-hmm. this is following up on what Will just said and the other caller as well. A quote that didn't get quite as much attention in that article was the sergeant in the field who challenged General McChrystal face to face, saying that the war was not going well and that they were not winning. I think that this is coming at a really critical point where General Petraeus is going to have a very difficult time in Afghanistan. I don't think that we can get away from that point. It's not just the issue of popular support for the war back home. It's support for the strategy among the soldiers, the men and women who are actually carrying that battle out, and real second thinking and ambivalence on the part of the Afghan government that has to be a partner in this effort. So General Petraeus had tremendous success in Iraq. Whether he can duplicate that in Afghanistan, I think, is really a big question.
Jack Beatty, I'd like your thoughts on this.
I think the idea that he can somehow duplicate it is magical thinking. I mean, you know, you can just go through all the differences between these two countries. But the largest one, of course, was the key to the success of the surge, was the surge within Iraq. That is, the surge of the Sunnis turning against Al-Qaeda-inspired Sunnis. Essentially, that was the key to everything that happened. And, of course, it still isn't wholly stabilized, and there's nothing analogous to that in Afghanistan. I think today's New York Times front page has the most hopeful note on all of this. Pakistan is said to pursue an Afghanistan foothold. Pakistan is a permanent fact. It lives there. That's its neighborhood. And it has every right to work out whatever deal it wants with the Afghan government. And the deal apparently on the table is allowing one of the guerrilla groups, one of the insurgent groups, into the Afghan government. Now, will we allow that? We're fools if we don't, because we're not a permanent geopolitical fact there. Pakistan is.
Tom Gelton, just to wrap this up, I'm curious the tone in Washington after this very dramatic week with General McChrystal stepping down.
Well, for the moment, as we've been discussing, for the moment, it's really brought a moderation of the debate that has been just exploding in Washington around so many issues. I mean, this is President Obama has bought himself some time here. With you played the quote from Senator McCain endorsing President Obama's decision here. So I think the overall tone is actually one of sadness. I mean, I think it's just General McChrystal has just been humiliated in a way that for any soldier, and particularly for a soldier who has devoted his entire life to the service to his country, he's been really humiliated in a way that I think just that makes people sad. I think you saw Admiral McCullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the at the Pentagon yesterday in a press conference, saying that he felt physically sick when he read this article. So I think that, you know, this is just a somber moment here in Washington.
Let's go quickly to the Gulf Coast before our break here. At a press conference on Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said that the Obama administration would appeal a New Orleans judge's ruling to block President Obama's moratorium on offshore drilling.
Continuing to drill at these depths without knowing what happened does not make any sense and puts the safety of those involved, potentially puts safety of those on the rigs and safety of the environment in the Gulf at a danger that the president does not believe we can afford right now.
Betsy Stark, we'll start with this and then continue after the break. But what does this decision mean for President Obama and for the oil spill itself, really?
Well, Jane, I think the public perception is that neither the government nor BP can get a handle on this catastrophe. After nearly 70 days, the president's approval ratings have slipped to the lowest levels of his administration. And I think that, the sort of the inability to kind of get a grip on this is one of the reasons. And so I think what we see here is the government looking for a way to sort of show that it's trying to take control of the situation, but doing it in a way that politicians in the Gulf say is dealing a body blow to that economy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week in the news. Other stories this week, the U.S. stays alive at the World Cup after an astounding last-minute goal.
But Donovan has scored! Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA! Certainly through! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
Nor at Wimbledon, where a record-shattering match between John Isner and Nicholas Mahut. Isner triumphed after over 11 hours of play.
At long, long last, we have a winner. The serve and perhaps finally the resolve of Nicholas Mahut has finally been broken.
And David Letterman had this to say about the resignation of General Stanley McChrystal.
He's being replaced by General David Petraeus, and when Petraeus got the news, he was so excited he fainted again. Remember a couple of weeks ago? Fainted, well, that happened again.
We're joined this hour by Tom Gelton, NPR correspondent, Betsy Stark, former business correspondent for ABC News, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. By the way, American John Isner lost his second-round match at Wimbledon. Poor guy. He'll go down in history regardless. Let's go back to the oil spill in the Gulf panel. Here's some sound from a Democratic National Committee ad that was released this week, slamming Republicans, including Joe Barton of Texas, Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, Eric Cantor of Virginia, Kentucky Senator, Senate candidate Rand Paul, for their statements on BP and the Gulf oil spill.
But I apologize. The Republican Party standing up for big oil and apologizing to BP. What do they say about holding BP accountable?
I think that sounds really un-American.
That we shouldn't be so hard on BP.
President Obama stopped demonizing BP.
Absolutely.
And Republicans call BP's escrow fund a
shakedown
and
extortion.
So I apologize. Apologizing to big oil. This is how Republicans would govern. The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Betsy, Jack Beatty, Betsy Stark touched on the political fallout from the oil spill before the break. How do you see it? Who stands to gain and who stands to lose from this?
Well, that ad is targeted to you might say, manna from Barton, the gift that Joe Barton gave the Democrats last week. BP in the NBC poll is now at 6% favorable rating. O.J. Simpson has a higher rating. And the Democrats point out it wasn't just Barton who said that. 115 other congressmen, GOP congressmen, signed a letter talking about calling the BP escrow account a shakedown. So that's the Democratic offensive. We're going to hit them with oil all the time. On the other side, you have the president has really taken a hit, maybe 5 points in the last 6 weeks, according to Rahm Emanuel. For every point the president is beneath 50%, the Democrats lose 4 or 5 House seats. By his calculation, that would mean the Democrats just in the last month have lost 20 seats. So the president's popularity is sinking. The oil is still leaking. Whether the McChrystal firing can give him a fillip, a temporary boost, we don't know. But it's BP all the time for the Democrats, and it's an ineffectual portrait of a president and the Democratic Party for the Republicans.
Beth has a comment on this point from Schenectady, New York. Hi, Beth. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, I was going to say that the federal government has all the facts at hand to provide a perfect and brilliant brief as to why the oil drilling should be stopped. They're supposed to carry out the inspections, they handle the regulations, and if they can't put together a non-generic, a non-general brief, a very minutely detailed brief, that's just terrifying. I believe that the judges that struck down the moratorium on drilling is a corporate shill to the oil industry, but still, who has deeper pockets and more knowledge than the federal government? They were in charge of inspecting these rigs, and if they can't put together a foolproof brief, I believe that they're lying, or they're just deliberately not putting together a good brief because they have all the information at hand to do so, just to put a perfect brief together to keep this moratorium in place.
Beth, thank you. Tom Gelton, your response.
You know, I think I don't know the poll numbers on this, Jane, but instinctively, I just bet that the American people would feel more comfortable with a moratorium right now. This has been such a terrifying, horrible experience to watch in the news every night, tar balls on the Florida shores and dead pelicans. I think Americans have been really traumatized by this experience. And, you know, you hear these comparisons, well, you know, a plane crashes, you don't suspend all flights. But I think that this has really been a turning point. To me, it seems that it's been a turning point in the American public's view of offshore drilling. And I just bet that Americans will not feel comfortable with this until they can be convinced that this is a problem that is not going to happen again, that there are regulations in place to make sure that companies put in the kind of safeguards that are necessary so that there isn't an accident like this again.
Here's another call on this point from Buffalo, New York. Alice is on the line. Hi, Alice. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. I understand that the state of Louisiana has benefited greatly in many ways due to its warm relationship with the oil company, and I want to know what the state did about it and when the government, federal government, should have come in. I think our founders would be crying over the petty behavior now.
Alice, thank you. Here's Harriet in Deerfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Harriet. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My point is that as a former legislator who knows the hiring process and the rules and the regulations in environment, that I am very afraid when our country does not have a department that did a proper inspection and licensing of this drilling, as well as the fact that they cannot now take care of the problem, and we haven't got the people to know how to take care of it.
Thank you very much, Harriet. Betsy Stark, you can sense the tremendous anger about this. There's a new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll just out suggesting that the overwhelming majority of adults in this country favor stronger regulation now of the oil industry, believes that the spill will affect the nation's economy and the environment. How do you see it?
I mean, I think that there, what this has underscored is the urgency for regulatory reform of this whole process of oil drilling. And one of the scary things is that the abuses seem to be ongoing. I thought one of the things that was very alarming to learn this week is that federal regulators at MMS, which may go down in history as one of the most dysfunctional and incompetent and cozied up to industry federal agencies ever, has apparently given BP a green light to drill an even deeper water than it's drilling in the Gulf, in the Arctic, because they've been allowed to classify the project as onshore rather than offshore. Mm-hmm. So the need for reform of this permitting process and for the rules governing the drilling in these kind of precious environmental places in our country, mm-hmm, is really urgent.
Betsy, thank you. Let's get to politics now. In a runoff primary on Tuesday of this week, Nikki Haley easily won the GOP's nomination for governor of South Carolina. She's the first woman to win a major party's gubernatorial nomination in that state.
This is a great night for the Republican Party, who's getting behind the people that have said we want a conservative government and we want a government that is accountable to the people.
Jack Beatty, what do the results from Tuesday's set of primaries and runoffs mean, do you think, for the coming elections in November?
Well, I think in Nikki Haley, the Republicans have a potential star and a potential story. A minority, an Indian American, very conservative, dynamic, apparently an excellent speaker. And someone who has a certain Teflon quality. She's weathered, rumors and scandals and charges that seem to have been without foundation. So I think we're going to hear from her. What's interesting to me in this, she was endorsed by Sarah Palin, and the latest NBC poll has some bad news about that. I mean, yes, that works in a Republican primary, But for the general electorate, a Sarah Palin endorsement is worth minus 27%. So that, I think, indicates some of the problems the Republicans are having in nominating candidates who are Sarah Palin endorsed in the primaries, but then they have to face a general electorate that, at least in larger states, does not regard the Sarah Palin imprimatur as anything but the kiss of death.
Tom Gelton, how do you view elections upcoming in November?
Well, you know, returning to the South Carolina case, the other really interesting race there was Tim Scott, an African-American Republican, beating Paul Thurmond, the son of Strom Thurmond. So South Carolina, this state that has acquired the reputation for its dysfunctional politics, particularly on the Republican side, now has two very impressive new faces to offer the nation, Indian-American running for governor and an African-American running for Congress. And I think that really shows how, to me, it shows how the United States has matured as a democracy, that in both those cases, race and ethnic factors were really sort of put aside. I mean, there were racial slurs in both those campaigns, and they ultimately proved not to be consequential. And that, to me, that's a really hopeful sign. Mm.
On that point, here's Bill from Waterbury, Connecticut. Hi, Bill. Thank you for waiting, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, my point is that I can't believe how fickle the American people are. Everything that's going on, even in the last week with the oil leak and the war in Afghanistan and financial reform, these are all legacies of the Bush administration. And a year and a half into the Obama presidency, for the American people to be saying, he's not cutting it, his poll numbers are dropping, it's outrageous. You can't undo 8 years of malfeasance and incompetence with a year and a half of the Obama presidency. I can't believe how people are just turning on him so quickly.
Bill, thank you. Betsy Stark, how do you view the president's approval ratings?
Well, I think that your listeners' point on that notwithstanding, I think that the reality here is that the president does own all these things now, a year and a half into his administration. And I think that that what we've got between this oil spill, between an unpopular war, between an economy that can't quite get on its feet is, you know, dare I say, a national malaise. And I think that's what's weighing down the president's approval ratings right now.
Let's, in our final minutes here, look ahead to the hearings upcoming in Washington. Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan will begin those hearings next week. On Wednesday of this week, Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama and a leading Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, spoke with Fox News about his demand that withheld documents be released before those upcoming hearings.
If there's a circumstance in which legitimately producible documents are deliberately being withheld, I don't take anything off the table of what should be the proper response from those of us who want to go forward with a full hearing with the basic documents. So I don't predict what might happen, but it would be a serious matter indeed if legitimate documents are being withheld.
Tom Gelton, what do you expect from the hearings upcoming on Elena Kagan?
Not a lot of news, actually, Jane. I think that this is another example of what Jack said earlier. Thank goodness for the oil spill or the McChrystal firing. Both those stories have really eclipsed the debate over Elena Kagan as a Supreme Court nominee. And we also have the Republicans on record as saying that they will not filibuster in this case. So I don't think that there's really much suspense around the question of whether Kagan is going to be confirmed for the Supreme Court position. There will be some fire around these hearings, but ultimately I think that she is headed fairly easily for confirmation.
Jack Beatty, you agree?
Yes, it's clear. I hope that she lives up to her own claims. I mean, she wrote a piece some years ago criticizing these hearings, saying they're all shams. The nominee will not speak candidly, will not give their positions, and so on. And she made that seem like some great failure. Question is she now going to really talk her mind, or is she going to engage in this? Senator, I can't speak about that because it might come before the court, or these formulations that really produce vacuous hearings. I mean, the Sotomayor hearings were, you know, your hair hurt just watching them. So it'd be interesting to see whether she's more candid.
Betsy Stark?
I think Tom and Jack have got it exactly right. I think we'll probably go through the kabuki theater of it all. She'll read from the Roberts, Alito, Sotomayor script of pledging allegiance to stare decisis, trying to answer every question without saying anything controversial. And in the end, I think she's likely to be confirmed.
So in our last minute here, Betsy Stark, take us out with a bit of news that I know you unearthed this week from the airline industry.
Well, as if it weren't bad enough to be charged for getting your luggage on board, to be to have no food or pay for a snack, or now the newest thing from the airlines, Jane, is that if you want to avoid those long lines at the airport at check-in time, you're going to have to pay for that too. What else will they think of? I can't imagine.
Well, thank you very much to my panel today. Really great discussion of the issues at hand. Betsy Stark, former business correspondent for ABC News. Thank you very much, Betsy.
Thank you, Jane.
And Tom Gelton, NPR correspondent, covers a wide variety of global security and economic issues. Tom, it's always nice to speak with you. Thank you.
It's always nice to be on your program.
Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Thanks, Jack. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Huang, Eileena Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marie K. Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.